The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Thursday, February the 14th. Today, Hezbollah threatens retaliation as supporters bury their assassinated military commander in Beirut. After the death in the UK of Georgia's richest businessman, a meticulous police investigation to find out whether he was assassinated.
The key to it really is going to be the toxicology report to establish whether he could have been in any way poisoned.
Also in today's show, pressure grows on China to stop the violence in Darfur as Steven Spielberg quits as artistic advisor to the Olympics. And Professor Richard Dawkins, God bless him, debates science, faith and atheism with one of his critics, The Guardian's columnist Madeleine Bunting.
That, of course, is the difference between us. I'm interested in truth, you're interested in human beings. And it's really as simple as that.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis. From Guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's today's headlines with Sandy Waugh.
The results of a post-mortem examination are expected later after the death of an exiled Georgian billionaire. Badri Patar Khatshishvili collapsed at his home in Surrey on Tuesday. The 52-year-old had recently spoken about being assassinated. According to his family, he suffered a heart attack, but police say they're treating it as suspicious. Last night, a special post-mortem was ordered, which included a range of toxicology tests. Detectives say no trace of any radioactive substances have been found. More on the background to this later in the programme. Five young Muslim men have had their terrorism convictions quashed. Judges concluded reading Islamist material was not illegal unless there was direct proof it was being used to inspire violent extremism. They were jailed in 2006 after they were found with ideological CDs and downloads. The prosecution claimed they were preparing to train in Pakistan before fighting in Afghanistan. Tuition fees are favouring the rich. A new study claims the fear of debt is putting teenagers from poorer families off university. Influential charity The Sutton Trust says more and more youngsters are now choosing to study closer to home. Those picking courses at nearby universities has risen from 18% in 1998 to 56% today. The governor of the Bank of England's admitted the economy may grind to a halt this year, but Mervyn King has warned the continuing risk of inflation makes further interest rate cuts unlikely. In last night's UEFA Cup games, Everton picked up a 2-0 away win at Norwegian side Brann, and it finished goalless between Rangers and Panathinaikos at Ibrox. Now for this morning's papers, the FT pictures the Georgian tycoon as police investigate what exactly happened to him. The Telegraph asks, is it a second Litvinenko? On the front of the Independent, a letter from the world's Nobel laureates to the Chinese president. They're demanding he acts on Darfur. The Mirror and the Mail both splash with the same picture of Prince William drinking at a pub where a teenager was bottled. And a couple of the back pages focus on the chief executive of the Premier League. The Express claims Richard Scudamore is having to backtrack on his plans to play games abroad, with the Sun sticking his face on a cartoon character Scooby-Doo next to the headline, "You haven't got a Scooby." There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
There are fears today of a fresh wave of unrest in Beirut as the funeral takes place of Hezbollah's military commander. Hezbollah has threatened revenge after Imad Mukhnaya was killed in a car bomb attack in a plush suburb of Damascus. Also today in Beirut, there's a mass rally to mark the anniversary of the murder of the former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri. The Guardian's Middle East editor Ian Black is in Beirut. He says Mukhnaya was one of the world's most wanted men.
Well, he was a very shadowy figure, but also a very notorious one. What we know about him is that he was in his mid to late 40s. He was Lebanese, and he's been around since the early 1980s, associated with some pretty spectacular events. I mean, just to name a few of them, he was said to be behind the kidnapping of Western hostages, people like Terry Waite and John McCarthy in Beirut in the early 80s. Around the same time, he was blamed for masterminding a very spectacular attack, a suicide bombing on American Marines who were then based in Beirut as part of a peacekeeping force after the Israeli invasion. And fast forward, he's said to have been behind the planning for the Hezbollah raid across the Israeli border when they kidnapped two soldiers and triggered the war of 2006. So he's had an extraordinary career. He's a wanted man of the most intelligence agencies in the world, but particularly the Israelis and the CIA you would imagine, would have been, you know, very, very anxious to get their hands on him or to give him a taste of his own medicine. And that's what seems to have happened.
But we don't know yet who was behind this.
We don't know who was behind it, and I don't imagine we ever will know definitively. It's not the kind of thing where, you know, you have a statement saying we did this and to this terrorist. I don't think it works like that. These are organizations which, you know, operate in the shadows. It must have taken a tremendous feat, I would have thought, of surveillance, time and money to track this guy down. I mean, he really was very, very elusive. He'd basically been on the run for a quarter of a century. Now, the Israelis, who are the prime suspects, certainly in the Arab world, have denied having done it. Is that a credible denial? Well, it's hard to say. Certainly in Lebanon, in Syria, and in this part of the world, the Israelis will be the prime suspects. The Americans have been after him, though, as well. He killed a lot of Americans. There was a reward, I think, of several million dollars on his head. And really, before we all, you know, became obsessed by bin Laden and the jihadis, this guy, Mughnir, was probably the most wanted man.
Now, Ian, you're in Beirut, and that's where Mughnir's being buried today.
He's being buried early this afternoon in the southern suburbs of the city. That's the Shia area, and it's the stronghold of Hezbollah, the organization that has claimed him as a martyr. And it's also, by unhappy coincidence, the same day on the other side of Beirut that there's going to be a mass rally commemorating the assassination 3 years ago of Rafiq al-Hariri, the former Lebanese prime minister, who many people think was killed by the Syrians. And that really, those are two big events happening on either side of the very sharp political divide in this very divided country. I think there's going to be quite a few tense hours as those two events take place back to back.
Is Syria still a safe haven for Hamas and Hezbollah leaders?
Well, I think you would have to say that they thought so. And I think that a very important part of this story is that by carrying out an assassination like this in the heart of Damascus, there is a message, there is a point that says, well, it's not safe. You know, you think that you're out of harm's way. Well, we, whoever we are, we can come and get you.
That was Ian Black in Beirut. And there's breaking news from Beirut today at guardian.co.uk/Lebanon. Also on The Guardian's beautifully redesigned website today, I have always been inspired by the films of Godard, Visconti, Pasolini and Fellini, and hope that I may one day make something that comes close to their genius. The words of Madonna. Filth and Wisdom, Madonna's first attempt at directing a film, was screened in Berlin last night. You can find out what Peter Bradshaw thinks about it at guardian.co.uk/film. Michael Tomasky asks whether Hillary Clinton's campaign for the Democratic presidential ticket is now doomed. That's at guardian.co.uk/America. And it's Valentine's Day today. I hope yours is suitably rose-tinted. John Joe McFadden argues that monogamy makes us more socially sophisticated beings. Have your say on that at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. That's Georgia's richest businessman, Badri Patarkatishvili, speaking at an anti-government rally in Tbilisi in 2007. After that, Mr. Patarkatishvili lived in exile in the UK, where he died yesterday of an apparent heart attack. But he claimed to live in fear of being assassinated. Surrey police are investigating that possibility. The Guardian's Ian Cobain told me what detectives are looking at.
It's all going to hinge upon the post-mortem examination, so there will be tests carried out to try and establish why Mr. Patarkatishvili died, and if there's any, if it is, for example, the result of a heart attack, which is what his family immediately thought, where there's any underlying cause of that heart attack which suggests any foul play. The key to it really is going to be the toxicology report, really close examination of his blood and other tissue to establish whether he could have been in any way poisoned. We're not expecting the results of those reports imminently. I think that Surrey police will want to be really very thorough in this matter, and it could well be that we won't know for some time.
He had expressed concerns that he'd be murdered by the Georgian authorities in league with Chechen rebels.
He claimed shortly before Christmas that he had become aware of a plot to kill him, which he said was being hatched by figures within the Georgian Interior Ministry in collusion with some Chechen gangsters. He, as supposed evidence for this, he produced a tape recording of a couple of men talking in Russian about a plot to kill him. It's impossible to know who is on the tape, how it actually came into the possession of Mr. Patakasishvili. It really is difficult to know whether it genuinely is evidence of a plot to assassinate him or not.
Is Georgia's Secret Service capable of carrying out an assassination of this kind, even if its government wanted him dead?
I'd find that very difficult to answer. Prior to the murder of Alexander Litvinenko, there was an assumption that the FSB, the successors of the KGB, would not attempt to kill any of their enemies or supposed enemies in London. And then we discovered that Litvinenko had been poisoned with polonium-210, a substance which does indicate some degree of state involvement in his murder. Would the Georgians ever do such a thing? Well, there's no evidence that they ever have, certainly. It's very difficult to answer that question.
But there is a connection between Patakatishvili and Andrei Lugovoy, the chief suspect in the murder of Litvinenko.
Lugovoy was a bodyguard of Patakatishvili for a number of years when he was running a television station in Moscow. And at one point, Lugovoy spent a fair bit of time in prison accused of trying to spring one of Mr. Patakasishvili's friends from prison. That is a whole escapade which led to Mr. Patakasishvili leaving Russia and moving back to his native Georgia. And in his absence, he's faced a number of criminal charges for fraud and for alleged involvement with the prison.
What was he doing in the UK?
He was very much involved in property in the UK. He invested a lot in property. He had his own properties, but he invested in involved in building luxury houses. He spent an increasing amount of time here as he came to fall out with the Georgian authorities. He spent time between his homes in London and Surrey and another home which he had in Eilat, the Israeli Red Sea resort. After December, when he really did fall out with the Georgian authorities, he considered himself no longer able to go back to Georgia and spent much of his time in the UK. It's also widely thought that he may have had some interests in football, or was attempting to invest in football. His name was linked to an attempt to take over West Ham Football Club in August of 2006.
Ian Cobain there. My name's John Dennis, and you're listening to Guardian Daily. Still to come, the woman who wrote the screenplay to a film about Muslim women by Theo van Gogh, the director who was murdered by Islamists, asks France to protect her. And you'll hear how blundering civil servants managed to give almost £3 million to the wrong Newcastle.
I mean, Newcastle-under-Lyme says very firmly they took it in good faith, and they'd done a lot of business regeneration. They just got a new bus station, for example.
But first, today China's still preparing its response to Steven Spielberg's resignation as artistic advisor to the 2008 Olympic Games in Beijing. The film director was protesting at China's failure to distance itself from genocide and human rights abuses in the Darfur region of Sudan. Campaigners say that China's been fueling the conflict by sending it weapons and money. Last year, the actor Mia Farrow said that by his involvement in the Games, Spielberg risked becoming a modern-day Leni Riefenstahl, the German film director who became one of the Nazis' chief propagandists. This is what Mia Farrow told The Guardian on a trip to London a couple of months ago.
Khartoum has the full and unwavering support of a giant, and that giant is China. As we know, massive oil companies pour oil revenues into Sudan to the tune of about $2 billion a year. Some 70% of that money is used to attack the people of Darfur. Now we look to China. Also, it's protected Sudanese interests on the Security Council, rendering toothless every single resolution. Now they're hosting the Olympic Games. I say they cannot host the Olympic Games at home and underwrite genocide in Darfur.
In Beijing, for The Guardian, is Tanya Brannigan.
Well, there's been very little reaction indeed, which is quite telling in itself. One reason is that the authorities are obviously pondering how to respond to this. And we understand that the Beijing Organizing Committee for the Games is now preparing a statement, but that may take some time to emerge. But what's more striking, of course, is that there's no reaction from the ordinary Chinese people because it's simply not being announced. There's nothing on the state media at all about Spielberg's decision. And that's interesting because, of course, they did announce that he was appointed in the first place, and they regularly run these Olympic updates and have all sorts of information there. So, yes, not much news of it over here.
Do you think there's any chance at all that China will change its stance on Darfur and in other areas where it's facing criticism on human rights?
Well, that's a very good question. And arguably, a lot of foreign affairs analysts would say that China has moved already on Darfur quite noticeably and on issues such as Burma, partly because of the Olympics. It knows its international prestige is on the line. And although they certainly haven't moved away from their doctrine of non-intervention, they're perhaps allowing a little more nuance and shading around the edges.
China's been successful so far at keeping its 2008 Olympic Games unpolitical. Is there now a danger that that will change?
I think what you really have to understand from China's point of view is that these games in Beijing are sort of a crowning moment, really, for the country as a whole. And not just for the government, but for a lot of ordinary citizens. They perhaps see it at the moment as the moment at which China's growing economic and political and general international influence will really be recognised by the world. And so regardless of whether people pull out or not, there's a sense that if there's too much criticism, it is embarrassing for the government, it takes away from the focus. And I think perhaps there is a certain feeling of, well, why are you having a bash at us? You know, you're not recognising the progress that China's made. So they're certainly very anxious that it goes off smoothly, that there aren't these constant headlines about Darfur, about Tibet, and about human rights. And actually, in some ways, that's perhaps one of the most interesting questions here, which is why has the Olympics become so associated with the issue of Darfur in particular, where arguably the Chinese have really moved quite a lot in response to concerns about their stance. And yet, when it comes to something like human rights, there's been much less publicity around that.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
The Somalia-born writer and Dutch MP Ayaan Hirsi Ali wrote the screenplay to the film Submission, which portrayed abused Muslim women with text from the Quran written on their near-naked bodies. The film's director, Theo van Gogh, had his throat slit by an Islamist extremist. In a note left on van Gogh's body, Hirsi Ali was threatened, and after that, she went into hiding in the US, as Angelique Chrysafis, The Guardian's Paris correspondent, reports.
She's been backwards and forwards. She's been in hiding various times in her life. She's currently under 24-hour guard, but she is based full-time in the US. The problem is, when she's in the US, the Dutch government won't pay for her security, and the US government says, well, we can't pay for an individual's personal guard.
Now, you've spoken to her in Paris, Angelique. What does she say in this interview?
She wants French citizenship. French intellectuals are backing her on that because then France will pay for her security. But France says, on the other hand, they are going to push the EU to open a fund whereby people like, say, Salman Rushdie and other people under fatwa or under threat from any kind of political extremism will be supported financially by Europe. I asked her in Paris what she expects France to do for her.
What I am hoping for, I'm desperate. I mean, I'm in a desperate situation. I have very intense threats to my life, that people will act on these threats.
Do you feel, are you under threat, whichever country you live in?
The threat is the most intense, according to the Dutch Secret Service in Holland. And in fact, one of the pressing needs to leave Holland at the time was, I couldn't live anywhere. I used to be moved frequently, sometimes out of the country. I've been moved to the US 3 times now. My neighbours in May of last year got a court order to evict me within 3 months. That was May, and by August I had to leave.
Do you regret taking part in the project with Theo and what happened afterwards?
I regret his death.
Do you think that France will come to her aid?
It's become a very political and moral issue for Nicolas Sarkozy, because when he was elected, he said that he would open France's arms to the martyred women of the world. Now, his junior human rights minister called Ayane Hirsi Ali this week. She called her a Voltaire of modern times. Sarkozy's party is really pressurising the president to give her citizenship. But I have to say, the government has held off for the moment. They're considering the application. I think they're really pushing things in the direction of the EU.
Angélique Chrysaphis. One of the most vocal supporters of Ayane Hirsi Ali has been Richard Dawkins. Professor Dawkins, author of the best-selling book The God Delusion, is also one of the English-speaking world's strongest advocates of atheism. And The Guardian's Madeleine Bunting is one of Dawkins' fiercest critics. She's written a series of articles which you can read on our Comment is Free site. We got her together with Richard Dawkins for a debate, specially recorded for Comment is Free. Here, Madeleine puts her case.
What I care passionately about, just as passionately as you, is about how human beings do or don't get along. So the truth of the universe is in a way something that I end up, you know, rather, you would say incoherently, I'm sure, and I wouldn't argue with you, but there are large parts about the nature of the universe which I'm quite agnostic about.
That, of course, is the difference between us. I'm interested in truth, you're interested in human beings. And it's really as simple as that. And I believe that that is the key to a great deal of misunderstanding and apparent argument. When we have an issue involving human beings, when we're going on a political rally, when we're demonstrating against the war in Iraq or something like that, I will wave my banner with everybody else, and that's what I do as a political activist. But as a scientist, I care about what's true. And I don't say I know what's true, but I think it's a very important question. I don't say there are different kinds of truth. There's spiritual truth and there's absolute truth.
But surely you recognise a sort of emotional truth. I mean, in your private life, science doesn't really help you very much in making sure that you're a decent and kind and loving person to your immediate...
That's a quite different question, and I agree with that. But when I asked you the question, did Jesus have a father or not, that's not a question of that type. That's not a question of the type... Do you love your husband or your wife? That's a question of simple fact. Either it's true, or either Jesus had a father or he didn't.
That's Richard Dawkins talking to Madeleine Bunting. And you can listen to a longer version of that at guardian.co.uk/audio.
Hello, I'm Rosie Swash, and I'm taking over from Paul McInnes to bring you the latest Music Weekly. We've got an interview with new Swedish pop star Leaky Lee, reviews of the latest singles from Goldfrapp, Nick Cave in the Bad Seeds and Cut Off Your Hands. We've also got an extraordinary interview with Anton Newcombe, the man behind the Brian Jonestown massacre. He's put years of violence and drug abuse behind him, and he's calmed that temper of his to talk to us about his new album, My Bloody Underground. That's all on Guardian Music Weekly, available later today at guardian.co.uk/audio.
A Whitehall department paid out £2.8 million to the small Staffordshire market town of Newcastle-under-Lyme. Trouble is, the money from the Department for Communities and Local Government was supposed to go to the city of Newcastle-upon-Tyne. And Newcastle-under-Lyme isn't inclined to give the money back. Here's our Northern editor, Martin Wainwright.
It was money that was given in recognition of work councils had done on attracting new business. And if they attracted plenty of new business, the government match funded and said, you know, well done you, here's some more.
But the money was paid to Newcastle-under-Lyme and not Newcastle-on-Tyne.
That's right. And it was a very, very big bungle, because it was £2,800,000. And that is a tenth of the whole budget of Newcastle-under-Lyme. I mean, Newcastle-under-Lyme says very firmly they took it in good faith and they'd done a lot of business regeneration. They just got a new bus station, for example. they won Britain in Bloom 2 years ago. But it is a vast amount of money for a small council like that. And if you look at the council's accounts, it faithfully records that they got this huge sum of money and they put it in special reserves. And it quadrupled the reserves of Newcastle-under-Lyme Council.
How did these civil servants cock things up so badly?
Well, you'd expect people like me to say this, seeing how I'm in Leeds, but they clearly hadn't been out of London for a while. I mean, there are quite a lot of Newcastles. There's about five or six. There's one in Shropshire. There's another one near Monmouth, not far away. There's one, a famous one in Northern Ireland, Newcastle, County Down. But Newcastle-upon-Tyne is in a league of its own. You know, it is a regional capital. It's one of the biggest cities in the country. So it was a pretty big mistake.
And Newcastle under Lyme, it's such a lot of money to them that they're not going to give the money back.
No. Well, you can sympathise because Newcastle upon Tyne actually challenged this decision last year and said, look, we don't seem to be getting as much as we should. And so it was in theory checked. And the government came back to them and said, no, it is right. So Newcastle under Lyme has gone ahead and has used part of this money. And I think they will have to pay it back in due course. But they're saying, we can't possibly pay £2 million back now. Can we have 20 years? So I think the government will get it back eventually, but it'll be a long time. Newcastle upon Tyne is getting their money. They're going to get it, you'll be glad to hear, in 2 weeks' time.
Guardian Daily's producers today were Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.